I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Dr. Eyal Fruchter, head psychiatrist for the Israel Defense Forces and the man who first counseled Gilad Shalit after he was freed from multi-year captivity in Gaza. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I love this edition of Two Jewish, which I title, at least in my own mind, the Vacation and Summer Camp Show. When we get to June, it's definitely time to start thinking about leaving town and journeying outward and onward. It's hot, really hot now, and officially, summer is coming up. And so it must be time to play this immortal, eternally entertaining cut from the late great comedian Alan Sherman about kids going off to summer camp. Here it is, an annual tradition here on Two Jewish for the past, oh, more than 13 years, believe it or not. The classic tune, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada.
Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators, and the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fada, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mudda, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball. Gee, that's better. Mudda Fada, kindly disregard this letter.
A truly legendary piece of American Jewish music. It's very funny and human and appropriate for this time of year, with kids going away to what used to be called sleepaway camp, parents beginning to enjoy life again, missing our lovely, sweet children every single moment they are gone. The truth is that with the cost of overnight camps these days, what parents may find themselves missing most is financial solvency. Having had children at Jewish camps for the past decade or so, I can tell you that I am exaggerating a bit. It isn't really that expensive. I did just have to sell the family car to pay for it, and we'll be eating top ramen quite a lot this coming year, but it's all worth it. You know, the truth is it is worth it, Jewish camp, because when kids attend Jewish camp, they come back with an extraordinarily natural feeling about what it's like to live Jewishly every day, without a thought of protesting or criticizing the experience. At camp, being Jewish is completely cool, the way it should seem in everyday life and at the synagogue, but sometimes doesn't. If we could introduce all of our children to a totally Jewish environment like camp and make it a regular part of their lives, we would make an enormous amount of progress towards ensuring the future of the American Jewish community for generations to come. But it's also true that when we are able to replicate that kind of dedicated, embracing Jewish experience with adults and families and seniors in our Jewish homes and in our temples, we begin to create the kind of future for Judaism that's essential to our continued flourishing in this remarkable country. For Judaism was not made to be experienced in tiny bits or only in the synagogue. Judaism, a way of life, my grandfather, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan, called Judaism in his book of that title. As a way of life, Judaism is meant to include experiences and insights into every area of human life. When our synagogue holds a temple retreat or an Israel pilgrimage trip or an extended study session or a class like Adult B'nai Mitzvah, Adult Confirmation, even Taste of Judaism, we are also trying to create the best aspects of a Jewish camp experience, but for grown-ups. It's when we make Judaism a part of every part of our lives that we gain the greatest sense of goodness and holiness, of meaning and serenity. So do send your kids or grandkids to Jewish camp, but take some time to include Jewish rituals, study, prayer, and play in your own life every single day. It's also time for vacation. Some of us are heading out to enjoy the wide world outside of our home cities and towns. One of the great unsuspected pleasures of traveling is the chance to explore Jewish sites and living Jewish communities in far-flung places. I can assure you that we Jews have lived pretty much everywhere and have active synagogues in places you might never imagine they would be. It's always worthwhile, and often surprisingly gratifying, to go out and find Jewish communities to pray with, or to meet people, or to see the remarkable places Jews have created in the far corners of the world. You can find Jewish places almost everywhere you go. Well, maybe not Antarctica or Fiji, but almost everywhere. Look up Jewish travel online, and just make sure you call ahead if you're going to a temple. Unfortunately, in today's world, many of the places around the world with synagogues require advance information on who is coming for security reasons. Of course, the greatest Jewish destination of all is Israel. But there are synagogues, Jewish museums, monuments, and wonderful Jewish places to visit in every corner of this globe. I can vouch for it. I've been to many of them. Search them out on your own travels this summer. To continue our theme of Jewish summer experience, here's a fun tune from the irrepressible Doug Kotler in honoring of visiting Jews everywhere, at least everywhere in the USA. It's called California Jews.
The East Coast Jews wear suits to every synagogue of there. And the Southern Jews with their friendly ways. I feel so good. Burning through each
was Doug Kotler's very silly California Jews for summer vacations to Jewish communities everywhere in the USA and everywhere else. When we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Dr. Eyal Fruchter, head psychiatrist for the Israel Defense Forces and the man who first counseled Gilad Shalit when he was freed from Hamas's multi-year captivity in Gaza. Dr. Fruchter will explain how psychiatry has changed in Israel in its approach to post-traumatic stress disorder and other issues affecting soldiers, and what it was like to meet with Gilad Shalit after his liberation. Find out more in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dr. Eyal Fruchter, is a 20-year veteran of the IDF, the Israeli military, who has served in the field and command as a military doctor, flight surgeon, and perhaps most importantly for us, a military psychiatrist. He retired as the head of the Mental Health Department in the Medical Corps of the IDF, specializing in post-traumatic stress and military suicide prevention, and has been involved in some remarkable work in the course of that experience. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
So how does a psychiatrist end up serving in the IDF for so long?
Well, I started as a military doctor, then I grew up. I specialized in psychiatry, and I stayed. The Army does need psychiatrists.
I would think that you couldn't be in a, how can I say this, a better place or a place with more need for dealing with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other psychiatric disabilities of the tension of the war than being in the IDF. Is it a high level? Can you talk a little bit about the prevalence of these ailments?
Well, of course, the prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder is much higher in military sessions due to the combat. And it's a harder form of PTSD because it's a combat PTSD, which is regarded as very severe and complicated one. But also there are in the Army, in the all the armies, there are more suicide events. So suicide prevention is also a big topic in military psychiatry. I think these are the most important two.
How does it work when a soldier's having trouble? Does he go to his commanding officer? How do they get referred to the psychiatric aspect of it?
Well, we've seen that there is a barrier to treatment for soldiers, because soldiers want to feel strong, so they don't rush into the psychiatrist. And that's a problem, of course, because sometimes they need treatment and they don't come. So one option, of course, is coming through the commander. But an even better option that we have implemented is to bring the mental health officer to be a part of your unit. So he is a comrade in the unit, he is an officer in the unit, and the soldiers see them all the time in the barracks and in the dining room and in drills and trainings and everywhere. So they know they are a part of the unit, so they don't feel so threatened to come and talk with them.
You know, it reminds me of the old American TV show MASH, in which there was a psychiatrist attached to the doctor's unit, so they felt embedded. It was seeing someone that you already know, not going to some strange situation that makes you feel weak.
Yes, that's a great example. But, you know, MASH was a military hospital, of course.
Right.
So he was a psychiatrist in the facility of doctors, which is, of course, obvious today, probably wasn't that obvious, for instance, in the Second World War. But in the MASH times, of course, it was obvious. Putting the mental health officer within the unit is even further in. So today you would see, of course, one in the military facility, the medical facility, but most of the mental health officers are really in the front, in the unit, and not just on clinics or in hospitals. It's more like what you know about the chaplains, if you look at the military here. There are chaplains in every brigade and in every battalion even. And we want a mental health officer in the IDF in the level of the battalion.
Fascinating. We will talk much more with Dr. Eyal Fruchter about the treatment of mental illness in the military and also about Gilad Shalit when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Now I want to express my thanks. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm glad and grateful that the modest cash awards we started with some 10 years ago have grown into a rather substantial amount with the help of donors like many of you. The Kohan Foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan of blessed memory, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That service can be in one of four areas: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. Our past award winners include some truly amazing people, and we are grateful for the chance to reward them and their fine work. Do you know of someone who could qualify for a Kohan Award in 2015? Or will you consider participating in this work yourself? Please go to our website, www.kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, where you can find all the information on nominating and on participating in this great work. And we'll be glad to hear from you. Our goal is to help people who work for the whole Jewish people. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco. People don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes: propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there, or the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. We are now pleased and serene to welcome back a recurring feature of Too Jewish: deep wisdom from Zen Judaism. Wherever you go, there you are. Your luggage is another story. That was the deep wisdom of Zen Judaism, a koan for today. We welcome our movie non-Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Oshrat. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking about the challenges of the Klita, the absorption of Ethiopian immigrants into Israel now more than 30 years. There have been many challenges. There have been some great success stories. I got a chance to visit one of them about a year ago in Beit She'an. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Chava Alamo, she's an amazing woman. I met her almost 12, 13 years ago when I worked with Ethiopians all over the northern of Israel and with their parents. And I remember that when I met her, she shared with me her dream that she just wanted her kids, all the, you know, Ethiopian kids to be, first of all, to be familiar with the story of their families, with their heritage, with the language that they never knew how to speak, like Amharic. And so they will be proud of their parents and, you know, grandparents, because the fact that they were shy about their, you know, they disconnected from
their heritage.
No roots. Right. And, you know, I don't need to tell what kids, how kids can grow up like, without roots, you know.
It's very challenging.
Very challenging. And so we came up with a very nice program called Roots Theater, and she and seven more women just share their personal story of making Aliyah. Different stories, very moving, very sad, fun, you know, funny stories about making Aliyah at the age, she made Aliyah at the age 12 without her parents, just chasing after her brother and his friends. And when it was too late to send her back to the village, she just made Aliyah. And then she was here, met her husband. She has seven kids.
Wow.
Seven
yeah, she
kids.
Does,
you saw
looks,
her.
She looks like
a teenager.
It's incredible. Mamash. Exactly.
And
same.
One of them, he was with special needs, by the way.
Yeah. Oh.
Anyway, and then after we completed 12 years of, you know, this theater, root theater, telling the stories of Ethiopian people all over Israel and actually out of Israel. And then she said, I don't want just to share my story with people. I want people to experience it. So she built in her backyard a small village, Ethiopian village.
It's amazing.
And you can tell more about it.
I can. It's fantastic. You feel like you're in an Ethiopian village. You walk in, it's got sort of like a thatched, you know, hut look. It's got paintings from the village. The backyard, you can see some of the ways. I mean, it doesn't seem like a backyard. It seems like you're in an Ethiopian village. You can see the different techniques Mamash. They use, the clothing, the costumes.
The too cool. You can make your own coffee. You can coffee.
And by the way, she also serves you food with injera, and it's fantastic.
Nahon.
And you really feel like you've entered, but not just any Ethiopian village, a Jewish Ethiopian village. They talk about the Kes, who is the priest, the leader of the community, kind of their version of a rabbi. It's a fantastic experience.
And it's
really
the only one in Israel. It's called Garmachin Center, Beta Israel, in Beit She'an, and everyone is welcome as an individual or part of a group.
Yeah, anybody who's going to Israel this summer, you should definitely call me, call Ashrat at the Israel Center here in Tucson, Arizona, Wine Tribe Israel Center, and find out, because we'll put you in touch with her. And I will tell you, it's an incredibly memorable afternoon. And you will remember this maybe as much as anything on your whole trip to Israel.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ashrat, and we'll talk next week.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe walks into the local tavern and sees his friend Moshe sitting on a bar stool. He puts his hand on his heart and yells, "Oy vey, Moshe, I'm so sorry to hear about your factory burning down." Moshe whirls around, grabs Abe, and whispers in his ear, "Shh, you idiot. It's tomorrow." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the Book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, out into the land of Canaan to scout it and to see if it can be captured. The spies take a month and they see the whole land and report back to Moses. "The land is very good, flowing with milk and honey." They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it must be carried by 2 men on a pole, now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's gonna be great, only it's not. 10 of the 12 spies then report that the people of the land are huge. "We felt like grasshoppers next to them," they say, "and numerous. The city's fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance, in spite of having God's support." Only 2 spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report, saying that with God's help, the land can be taken, but the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, "Why did you take us from slavery just to kill us here at the hands of our enemies?" It's at this point the decision is made by God. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in just one generation. And so, after a failed, leaderless attempt to invade the land without God's approval or Moses' presence, the people are now condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, a total of 40 since they left Egyptian slavery, until a new young generation can emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a mentality of freedom. Shlach Lecha provides a great lesson in the process that's required to cleanse the trauma of failure from the minds of a community. Often it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or a country. It's the generational turn that comes from learning that things can be done differently and better, and that freedom is a birthright. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Dr. Eyal Fruchter, head psychiatrist for the Israel Defense Forces, will explain how psychiatry works in the active military now, how it is changing, and what it was like to counsel Gilad Shalit after he was freed from multi-year captivity in Gaza. We'll learn all that and much more when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
According to a new report from Amnesty International, the Palestinian terror regime of Hamas used the cover of last summer's conflict with Israel to torture and kill Palestinians from rival factions. Strangling necks, abduction, torture, and summary killings of Palestinians by Hamas forces during the 2014 Gaza-Israel conflict is a report released last week by Amnesty International. Normally no friend to Israel and far from objective where Palestinians are concerned, but this report highlights Hamas's extrajudicial execution of at least 23 Palestinians and the arrest and torture of dozens of others, including members and supporters of Fatah, the party of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, the Hamas rival. During the 50-day conflict last summer, July and August 2014, Hamas, quote, took the opportunity to ruthlessly settle scores, carrying out a series of unlawful killings and other grave abuses, said Philip Luther, director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Amnesty International. In the chaos of the conflict, the de facto Hamas administration granted its security forces free rein to carry out horrific abuses, including against people in its custody. These spine-chilling actions, some of which amount to war crimes, were designed to exact revenge and spread fear across the Gaza Strip, Luther said. Many of the unlawful killings, which took place in an operation codenamed by Hamas Strangling Necks. Boy, those Hamas guys are really subtle. They go to great lengths to hide their brutality, don't they? They were said by Hamas to be retaliation against Palestinians for collaborating with Israel in its Operation Protective Edge. However, at least 16 of those murdered by Hamas were in prison. Most already there on collaboration charges before the start of the conflict, according to Amnesty International. In addition, Hamas abducted other suspected Palestinians and tortured them, including severe beatings with truncheons, gun butts, hoses, and wire, or held in stress positions, the report said. At least three of those who were tortured died in Hamas custody. The Human Rights Organization has called on Palestinian leaders, including the Hamas government, to ensure that the cases documented in the report are investigated impartially and independently, and that wherever there is sufficient admissible evidence, suspected perpetrators will be brought to justice in proceedings that fully respect international fair trial standards and without recourse to the death penalty. Amnesty International also urged Hamas to cooperate with independent international investigations, including the Commission of Inquiry set up by the UN Human Rights Council in July of 2014. I cannot imagine Hamas really doing so. There is trouble in the West Bank too, but it's intra-Jewish trouble this time, between religious entities. Though the Israeli chief rabbinate might want him out, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, chief rabbi of Efrat, isn't going without a fight. The former leader of Lincoln Square Synagogue in New York, who led that modern Orthodox congregation to prominence in the 1970s and 80s, said that he will not accept the rabbinate's attempt to dismiss him as the chief rabbi of Efrat. The conflict is over disagreements on who has authority over Israeli conversions. I will remain the rabbi of Efrat for as long as the people of Efrat want me to be their rabbi, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, once known as Steve Riskin, said. I don't believe it's up to the chief rabbinate. Riskin also said that the chief rabbinate's conversion policy does not have the support of the vast majority of Israelis, which is certainly true. Riskin urged the rabbinate to accept a 2014 government decision reforming the conversion process in Israel. The chief rabbinate has declined to automatically renew Riskin's appointment and summoned him for a hearing on June 29th. Last week, the local government of Efrat, a well-established West Bank settlement town located in the Gush Etzion block, by the way, I spent a little time studying there a long time ago. Anyway, Efrat unanimously affirmed that it would like Riskin to continue as its rabbi. Should the chief rabbinate disagree, Riskin said he would simply disregard that decision. Aside from more liberal conversion policies, Rabbi Riskin is an advocate for women's spiritual leadership in the Orthodox community. In January, he appointed Jenny Rosenfeld, a New York native, as the first female spiritual leader to jointly lead an Orthodox community in Israel. There's a strong need for women's halachic, that is Jewish law, and spiritual leadership, said Rabbi Riskin. He picked Rosenfeld for the role in Efrat. Frankly, I jumped at the opportunity to work with her. She is being referred to as a manhiga ruchanit, a spiritual advisor. Rabbi Riskin, a co-founder of the community Efrat, expected an automatic reappointment to the Efrat chief rabbi post. He believes the rabbinate has delayed the reappointment mainly because he supports the government decision that devolved authority over Jewish conversion from the chief rabbinate to Israel's city rabbis. The rabbinate has come out publicly against that. Riskin has performed conversions that the rabbinate has not yet recognized. Riskin notes the conversion reform is necessary in order to provide a more flexible path to conversion for the hundreds of thousands of Israelis from the former Soviet Union who are still not Jewish according to halakha, traditional Jewish law. Jews from the former Soviet Union don't trust the rabbinate here, Riskin said. I remain very optimistic the chief rabbinate will understand that we're facing a time bomb with this problem of the Jews from the former Soviet Union. We can do a wonderful job converting the children as well as the adults in a warm and welcoming fashion. Riskin said he would not change his position in order to gain the reappointment. He called on the chief rabbinate to view his conversions as halachically legitimate, which I believe they are, and said a refusal to do so would be a very, very big mistake. He also said that any rabbinate depends on the acceptance of the overwhelming majority of the people. Asked whether the chief rabbinate has lost that, Riskin said, on the issue of conversion, yes, they have. He is a very prominent modern Orthodox rabbi with excellent credentials and a history of major accomplishments in the Jewish world. Riskin is also well known for having authored the weekly Torah portion column in the Jerusalem Post. This does not appear to be a fight. The rabbinate should be provoking. On a serious sociological note, one ongoing story this summer bears watching. Ethiopian Jews in Israel are struggling with what they perceive to be police bias and racism, as well as their status as a challenged minority. In the last few weeks, we have seen continued protests and marches through the streets of Israel. As we continue to follow this story, I must note that Israel is not racist the way America is. Skin color is not the major factor, and ethnic diversity is extraordinarily high in a nation that has immigrants from perhaps 200 countries, some of which don't even exist anymore. But the challenges Ethiopian Jews faced coming from what was in places a Stone Age culture into a postmodern information age nation like Israel have not entirely faded away over the past 15 or 20 years. By many measures, Ethiopian Jews have been absorbed successfully into Israel, and there are Ethiopian Jewish members of the Knesset and leaders in the army and in other fields, but by many social measures of success, this isn't the case. And the Ethiopian Jews have higher dropout rates, higher drug addiction and incarceration rates, and lower socioeconomic standing than almost any other ethnic group in Israel. Having worked with Ethiopian Jews when they first came to Jerusalem, 20-some years ago, I can tell you that this is a fascinating and wonderful community. They are both grateful to Israel for their return to the Holy Land and being freed from the endemic warfare and starvation of Ethiopia, but they also deserve special attention and require more help than they are currently receiving in a dynamic, highly technological Israel of the 21st century. The Israeli government has been somewhat responsive, but clearly has not yet done enough to assist the community at risk. We will continue to follow this story. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Dr. Eyal Fruchter, a longtime veteran of the Israeli Defense Forces who served in the field and in command as a military doctor, a flight surgeon, military psychiatrist. He retired as the head of the Mental Health Department of the Medical Corps of the IDF, specialist in post-traumatic stress disorder and military suicide prevention, one of the most important areas of the work. Dr. Fruchter, you, I guess, most famously were involved when Gilad Shalit was released. Can you talk a little bit about that experience, insofar as you can talk about it?
Yes, sure. Well, it was a great experience. It was very, you know, very exciting, very emotionally exciting for everybody. And I was very happy to facilitate in that, to take part in that. And we had... What I can share is that we had a lot of, we had very short time to prepare for that event, and we had a lot to do in that short time, because since the notice that he's going to be back and the return of Gilad, it took just, you know, three to four days, so we had to work very fast. We knew that we should prepare the family for his return, because after such a long time and such a long struggle everywhere, they've been quite exhausted, and usually retrieving prisoners of war takes a lot of effort, so they should have known what's expected. And we didn't know anything about his condition. We didn't know whether he will be just as well as he was, or eventually, or he will be in a totally... wreck situation. So we had to prepare everything for every condition he will be coming back. And the medical corps and all the army really worked very hard around that, so that his return will be as smooth as possible. Now we took lessons from the return of a lot of Yom Kippur prisoners, and from 1973, and the return of the prisoners from the first Lebanese war in 1982. And because since then, we didn't actually get prisoners of war back. But we learned from these returns that we should take the time and not bring him immediately to interrogations, which happened in Yom Kippur and was critically wounding even more some of the soldiers coming back. So we tried to make his coming back as smooth as possible, and everybody participated in that. So it really helped. And one more thing I wanted to share, it was very, you know, very emotional, his coming back. We didn't know anything, as I said, about what his condition. Until we've seen him on the Egyptian television just before his coming. We waited on the border for him to come. We knew that we should take him and run, because we had some intelligent rumors that we might be bombed at immediately when he comes into Israel, because some of the families of the Hamas people and other terrorist groups were not approving that their relatives were not freed as part of the deal. So we had rumors that we might be bombed at. So we waited for him, and we sort of scooped and ran with him to a safer place near the border, and then we took off with a helicopter flight that everybody's seen on television, and he was great. He was really doing great from the start, and we're very happy that he managed to cope that well.
It's an extraordinary story. When you say it was emotional, of course, it was not just emotional for Shalit or his family, but really for the whole country. How do you prevent that from affecting, it's a funny question, your professional judgment in a circumstance like that? There's a certain elation to the whole experience, isn't there?
Yeah, sure. Our job was quite simple. My job was quite simple. I wanted to check that his reality test is good and that he knows where he is and he knows at every step what is going to happen. So in this scenario that we planned ahead, if he is in good judgment and he's not psychotic or, you know, and he knows what's going on and where he is and where he's going to, then my basic role was to lower his enthusiasm and excitement and to let him know every step ahead what's going on, because we knew he was kept in a very quiet place and very isolated place, and we were quite afraid that if he's in a shaky position, the noise of the helicopters, the noise of many people around, and all the people around very interested in him, all the media exposure, might the overexposure might ruin things and be traumatic. So we managed to bring him to a relatively quiet zone and to prepare him all the way. That's why we were talking during the flight. He had special earphones, so the noise of the helicopter will be as quiet as possible. And I talked to him on the way and told him what is going to be happening and who he's going to meet and when is he going to meet who, so he knew anything ahead and could relax, at least train for that or be prepared for that. So that's it.
Really extraordinary experience. You alluded to the way that the first released prisoners were treated, like way back in 1973. I imagine that was part of the Mizrahi deal after the Yom Kippur War. There's always a balance between military need and the psychological health when someone's released from captivity. Is there still some tension within the military in this regard?
Well, in Gilad's case, there was no tension. It was relatively easy, because everybody knew, even in the intelligence, that he didn't know much, and so he couldn't say much.
Right.
He was not fit for his knowledge. In other times, there is a contradiction, because we want them to be kept and to be treated and to have the patience in treating them, and the intelligence forces want to know as much as possible what was told there, how did the interrogation go. Everybody knows that if you fall into captivity, you will tell anything you know. But they want to know the ways that they take it out. And from their questioning in the enemy's intelligence forces, you can learn a lot of what they know. So they, of course, need the prisoners of war to be as fast as possible in their hands, so you'll get as much information about the enemy as possible and about the damage that by being in captivity you made. Of course, nobody is to blame you, but you made some damage for the security of the country. But I do believe that our next, hopefully there won't be any, but if we will have, our next prisoners of war will be treated more like Gilad Shalit and by far less like the Yom Kippur prisoners, because the advantages of interrogating them as fast as possible is much smaller than the damage that it's causing. I do think that most of the prisoners from Yom Kippur shouldn't have been interrogated immediately upon coming back.
You know, it's a fascinating point you make, that everybody knows that you're basically going to tell everything you know. I hadn't really thought about that, but I guess it seems just obvious. So interrogating prisoners on what they knew in advance, you should probably know already what they knew in advance, shouldn't you, if you're in intelligence?
Yes and no, but, you know, because in the Army, you know, you talk with friends and you see things and right. you have your personal opinions on it. No, but what's important for the intelligence forces is from the questioning, they learn what the other side knows. For what they're looking for, especially, etc. So it's not just what you told; it's what the others know. And as long as it's fresh, you know, if you're kidnapped and being held a prisoner of war for 5.5 years, there's no rush. But if you are just being held, for a month or several weeks, everything is still fresh, that's the right time to interrogate you. We know from our talks with prisoners of war that the story of you being imprisoned does tend to change dramatically through the time, by the time. So when time flies, the stories tend to change.
So in America, we've experienced a great deal of, we've seen a lot of military post-traumatic stress, PTSD, and of course a lot of military suicides. Is there much exchange between the IDF and, say, the American military in treatment of these issues?
Well, there is exchange of knowledge. We had a problem of suicide, and our suicide rate was around 3.5 times higher than the general population over the many years until 8 years ago, it's the ninth year now, until we started the suicide prevention program, the revised suicide prevention program, you might call it. Because every time, you know, always there was a struggle again with suicides, but still it came to tremendous numbers and it didn't do well. And the Americans, it was the opposite way, actually. Until a little bit more than a decade ago, there seemed to be some programs working for suicide prevention, and the overall rate was a little bit less than the civilian world. Because it's a place of work, and because, unlike in Israel, the availability of weapons is always very high in the United States society, so being in the Army does not by much bring your availability of weapons to kill yourself into a higher position. And on the last decade, the American armies suffer from such high rates that they have passed. I think they're higher than 3 times the population, whereas our program does work. And we reduced our overall rate of suicide. If you look just at the last 5 years, you can see that we have reduction of over 60%. And of the overall years of the program, it's an overall reduction of more than 45%. So it's really amazing. We're very happy about that. We showed that to the American armies, and some of the things that are changing now in the American armies in that regard is that they also started sending the mental health officers into the unit level. So now they're getting on a model that we are building with an organic mental health officer within the unit level, again, in a battalion level. So they're still not there, but they're going towards that, and that's the lesson that I think we influenced the way that they think about that. Because they heard us speak about that quite a lot. And in the fighting against post-traumatic stress disorder, of course, we learn from each other a lot, and that's part of the reason why right now I am in the USC for a visiting scholar year, working on combined research on post-traumatic stress disorder and post-traumatic stress prevention in what is called CIR, the Center of Innovational Research for Veterans and Their Families. It's a part of the School of Social Work in the USC.
Well, it's incredibly important work, and it sounds like it's bringing some great solution, I don't know, solutions, but great ways of dealing with some very serious military issues. I want to thank Dr. Eyal Fruchter for a great visit here on Too Jewish, and continued success in your research and eventually on your return to Israel. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Randy Schoenberg, the attorney in the story told in the current film, The Woman in Gold, a pioneer in recovering art stolen by the Nazis to the families of its Jewish owners, and a leading figure in art restitution and the president of the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust. He is great. Don't miss that show next week. Our playout this morning comes from the Jewish Gypsy Orchestra album. It's an upbeat and Freilach Hora. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.